Welcome to the Center for Science, Technology, and Society podcast. The Social Entrepreneurship Action Research Roundtables, presented by the Global Social Benefit Fellows. Clean energy, unlocking economic potential.
Thank you for coming. My name is Nikki, and I'm one of the Global Social Benefit Fellows that traveled abroad this year. And today we're going to be talking about clean energy unlocking economic potential. And so I'm here to introduce three people. And before that, I'm going to talk about a little bit what the social fellowship is like. And so there's 14 of us in this fellowship. A lot of us are on this side of the room. And we traveled to 5 different countries with a variety of projects. So some were more business related, some were more in documenting in artistic ways, and everyone had different projects. And we learned a lot about what social entrepreneurship is during this experience. And so this fellowship is a research program providing social justice learning experience, including a mentored field-based study and a 9-month research for undergraduate juniors within the larger network of social entrepreneurs. And maybe after hearing about our experiences, you might be interested in applying next year, or you maybe just came to hear more about the challenges of the developing world and specifically about energy. So to get started, I'm going to introduce Jack first. Jack worked with Lifeline Energy in Zambia last summer. Lifeline Energy is a nonprofit social enterprise that provides technology solutions for off-grid learning, manufacturing, and distributing solar-powered and wind-up media players and radios. So first, Jack, what did you do specifically with Lifeline?
Thanks, Nikki. My job primarily with Lifeline was to work with a local agroforestry expert in the region to try and help them compile and create a curriculum for an agroforestry program that can be incorporated into this radio program system that they have going on there in southern Zambia. And the other half of my research there was geared towards doing some questions and finding out a little bit more about what it means to be living in energy poverty, which is sort of one of the topics of our discussion today. So,
and Emily worked with Solar Sister in Uganda. Solar Sister eradicates energy poverty by empowering women with economic opportunity. They combine the breakthrough potential of solar technology with a deliberately female-centered direct sales network to bring light and opportunity to remote communities in rural Africa. So now we'll hear from Emily about what she did.
Thanks, Nikki. So one of our major projects, we actually worked with a couple other social enterprises besides Solar Sister in Uganda, but we were primarily working with Solar Sister, and most of the time we were on the road. We were traveling up and down the country, east, west, meeting and interviewing all kinds of different women that work for Solar Sister, so women that sell lights to their communities, talking with them about their income, their expenses, how solar light has affected them, and how the added income of being a Solar Sister has helped them in their life. And so we got a lot of interaction with that kind of on-the-ground field, like market research, basically.
And Phil worked with Anudeep and iMerit in India. Anudeep and iMerit are sister social enterprises operating in eastern India. Anudeep provides livelihood initiatives for marginalized communities through rural education in IT, English, and workplace readiness. iMerit employs Anudeep's graduates in professional career building digital jobs. So now, Phil, if you could describe your involvement with the organization.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I was focused more on the media aspect. I worked along with Lauren and Melissa with Anudeep and iMerit to go in and work on some of the promotional tools for Anudeep and iMerit. So we spent a lot of time going out to the rural centers, 3 or 4 hour train rides outside Kolkata into to very, very remote areas where we were able to get a true feeling of what these organizations do and the people that they do this amazing work for. And we've been able to turn over some videos that iMerit and Anudeep can now use for promotion in their
me. So thank you so much for putting on this roundtable. I'll be your moderator today. So if you have any questions or insights that you think relate specifically to something that someone just said, you can raise your hand and ask them a question. And then we'll also have a question and answer session at the end as well. So now to get into the actual discussion, Phil is going to start us off.
Thank you so much. First of all, thank you all very much for coming. We really appreciate it, and we're really excited to tell you about clean energy and unlocking economic potential. First, we're going to go over the idea of social entrepreneurship as a development paradigm, as there may be some people in the audience who don't quite understand those phrases. Second, we'll be going over the current state of energy access globally. Third, how social entrepreneurship can address energy poverty. And finally, comparing competing alternatives for the provision of clean energy, followed by discussion of the merits and pitfalls of each. So first, social entrepreneurship. The Skoll World Forum describes social enterprises as creators of innovations that disrupt the status quo and transform our world for the better. But how exactly do they make that change? A social enterprise is an organization that utilizes commercial strategies to maximize improvements in human and environmental well-being. This focus on human and environmental well-being is often phrased as the triple bottom line, meaning that these companies have a responsibility to a social, economic, and environmental mission. Social enterprises often come in three different forms: non-revenue generating, hybrid, and for-profit. Non-revenue generating social enterprises rely on grants and donations. Hybrid has some form of revenue from their business model, but still rely on outside sources of income to make their organization run. For-profit relies solely on revenue streams they create through their own business models, though they often rely on loans and grants in the beginning phase of their development. And finally, how does social enterprise compare to other development paradigms? So on the one hand, we have this idea of the big push with aid, made famous by Jeffrey Sachs. A greater amount of aid into developing markets will accelerate the economic growth. On the other side is this idea of laissez-faire, allowing developing nations to build their economies through the free market without the help of foreign aid. Every development paradigm sort of falls in between those two ideas. I'm now going to turn it over to Jack, and he's going to talk to you about the current state of energy access globally.
Thanks, Phil. So now that we have sort of a basic understanding of social entrepreneurship, and some may have a better understanding than others, but the next necessary component is to talk about energy and what does that mean. So I'd like to just throw up some pictures up here and talk about what does energy mean to different people across the world. Here we have a picture of what most of us in the Western world consider to be energy or electricity. Oftentimes we consider these to be mostly synonymous terms. This is a grid that supplies us energy from a centralized power plant somewhere and wires it to all of our homes throughout the area. In our local area, that would be PG&E up there. However, energy means a lot of different things to many different people across the world and is not simply restricted to a grid. Here's an example of a charcoal brazier, which is used by many people in the developing world to cook their foods. Here they put a charcoal, which they buy at local markets, to in the bottom there, and then heat it up and cook most of their food like this. Here's an example of a different form of energy that a business might use in the developing world. A refrigerator that a restaurant might use to refrigerate its various cold beverages or snacks. Here's an example of a cell phone. This also has to do with energy. It's also very tied in with energy. You need to be able to charge a cell phone and to be able to use it. Cell phones are actually very prolific in the developing world, which is something that some people don't know. This is medical equipment, monitoring equipment, and things like that that also require energy in order to be able to run. Or we have a computer bank. This is similar to something that might be seen in a business that something like Phil's enterprise, EnergyDip, and I Merit worked with, where you need actually more energy than you would to run a cell phone to run something like this. And finally, here's a picture of a candle, which is how most people living off the grid in the world light their homes at night. So basically, when we're talking about energy, we have a definition that depends on who you're talking about.
And depending on that person, you have different applications and capacity levels that we're speaking on. At the smallest level, you have the villager, who relies mainly on things like this candle and the charcoal brazier cooking system that I showed earlier. This is the lowest, most basic form of energy for these people. Going up a level to the example of the refrigerator or something like that, that is what a restaurant might need, that type of energy, or a stove to cook their food. On an even higher level, you have something like an institution such as an internet cafe or a hospital that requires more capacity and more complex systems that are integrating this energy that they're receiving. And they need more than just a simple solar system or something like that. And then finally, like the first picture, we have the grid, which is the focus of government, for the most part. Okay, so now that we know that energy has many different states, we should talk about the status of world energy access in the world. The World Energy Organization defines energy access as having access to modern energy services in the form of household access to electricity and clean cooking facilities. So there we sort of have a distinction between electricity, which powers appliances and lights, and energy that can power cooking technologies or something like that. So there's a distinction there between electricity and simple energy in the form of fire or candlelight. 1.4 billion people on the planet live without access to modern electricity. 3.0 billion people on the world live without access to clean cooking fuels. That's almost half the people on the planet living without access to modern cooking technologies. More than 95% of these people live in either rural sub-Saharan Africa or developing Asia, and 84% of them are in rural areas. So some people often raise the question, why is it that countries like the United States and Western countries have access to energy? Why is it so easy for us to sit in a room that sort of incorporates all those different levels of energy that I was talking about? I mean, here we have lighting, we have air conditioning, we have a sound system, we have computers running, and we're not really thinking about where it's coming from or how we have it. It seems like we're taking it for granted. All we do is switch on a switch. Unfortunately, in most of the developing world, the grid, which is what's powering this system right now, is not nearly as prolific as it is here. And this is for many reasons and is sort of the subject of a lot of research that's going on right now surrounding energy poverty and what that means. One of the major barriers to grid expansion in the developing world would be government inefficiencies and the inability of governments to efficiently implement new programs or even really to find the funding, which is the next major barrier. It's really expensive to expand grids, especially to areas that don't have roads and other infrastructure that would make that easier. Even upgrading a grid and not extending it is highly costly. I think the estimates for to upgrade India's grid without expanding it whatsoever would be on the order of $200 billion or something like that. There's also issues with theft and energy transmission. When you transmit energy over long distances, it loses some of its power. And then also there's a lot of illegal tapping that happens in urban areas where people go up and they actually grab some of the, you know, they wire their own wire in and they take it down to their house and essentially steal grid electricity. So it's hard to regulate, and there's a lot of risk associated with establishing a power plant in a developing country. And then finally, there's capacity issues as a result of urbanization. And while I was in Zambia, and I'm sure other people who travel to the developing world on this fellowship experience this as well, we experienced something called load shedding, which is basically where the government at night, the energy providers simply can't handle the capacity that people are demanding for electricity. So they essentially just shut off the grid to certain areas of the city. So I think it was on our first night that we were there, recovering from our jet lag and all, we were sitting in around the table and all of a sudden the lights went off. And when the power goes out in the US, it's kind of a big deal. It's not something that happens all the time. And so I was caught off guard, certainly. I mean, everything, the refrigerator stopped working, the Wi-Fi was down, and of course the lights were off. So this candle actually is what our hotel staff started placing around the hotel to provide what little light we could. This is actually placed in the beer mosi. That's the national beer of Zambia. And this is how we had to live. This is the light that we had for about 4 hours that night. And I was aware of load shedding before I went, but I had never really experienced it. And what I came to realize is that this wasn't just an occasional thing. Zambian ZESCO, which is the Zambian energy provider, conducts load shedding in Lusaka, the capital, 3 nights a week. So Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday nights, they shut off the grid to the city, to certain sections of the city, from 6 to 9 p.m., which means that there's essentially 9 or more hours, because it's obviously not exact, that people are living without electricity, which means they can't run refrigerators, they don't have lights, they don't have computers running, and it basically takes a huge chunk of time where people could otherwise be productive. So this is sort of a large issue. I mean, it's a very interesting development problem that people have come to realize. And how many of you have heard of the Millennium Development Goals? 2000 Millennium Development Goals. I'm glad you guys should have all heard of that. This was an initiative started by the Millennium Development Project under the direction of the UN in 2000 to address the global development issues. Here we have a list of the 8 Millennium Development Goals. The first one is to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. The second one is to achieve universal primary education. The third is promote gender equality and empower women. 4 is reducing child mortality. 5 is improving maternal health. 6 is combating HIV and AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. 7 is ensuring environmental sustainability. And 8 is creating a global partnership for development. Interestingly enough, energy, despite affecting more than 1.4 billion people in terms of electricity and 3 billion people in terms of cooking sources, is not one of these Millennium Development Goals. Why is that? The short answer is they essentially forgot. It was a mistake by the United Nations to not have energy be a primary focus of the Millennium Development Project. Of course, since these were released in 2000, the United Nations and other institutions have realized this and have focused on trying to remedy this sort of gap in development, in the promotion of global development. The year 2012 was declared by the United Nations to be the year of sustainable energy for all. And there's an important distinction here. I mean, why is there a focus on clean energy? Obviously, a lot of the energy that we're using is not necessarily clean energy. As I'm sure many of you know, the non-renewable energy sources are concern for the environment, the broader environmental ramifications that go along with using fossil fuels. Also, being reliant on fuels and other non-renewable energies makes countries more vulnerable to fuel price volatility and security issues. And finally, sustainable energy has the potential to greatly reduce a lot of the health risks that many people face when they use fuels like the charcoal that I showed earlier. I mean, it's creating a lot of toxic fumes that have caused a lot of health problems and fires and pretty horrendous burns from kerosene lamps and things like that. And the goal of this initiative, the Sustainable Energy for All, is to provide modern energy access, hopefully sustainable energy, to all by the year 2030. And the UN has stated that without access to modern energy, it is not possible to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. According to the World Bank, however, it would cost $485 billion a year for the next 16 years to meet this goal. That's a lot of money. So the UN might have been late to this party. They might have missed this when they're talking about the Millennium Development Goals. But haven't others been working in this sphere? There has to have been another group of people recognizing this need in the development situation. One of these groups is what Phil just described, the social enterprises. There's a small group of social enterprises that have been working to provide energy in unique and interesting ways. Some of you might be very familiar with this. I know myself and Emily and Andy back there certainly are. This is the Energy Map, which is sponsored by the Center for Science, Technology, and Society here at Santa Clara University. It's essentially a map that is trying to compile all of the different social enterprises that are working in the clean energy sphere. Each one of those dots up there represents the headquarters of a social enterprise helping to remedy either cooking fuel gaps or electricity gaps. If you can see, I mean, it's blurry down there at the bottom, but so far, the work on the energy map, we've identified over 60 enterprises working to help deal with this. While we were doing the research for this program, we decided for this roundtable here, we decided to go through and sort of look at the impacts of these enterprises working in this sphere. And what we actually found was that even on our most generous, you know, assumptions or extrapolations based on the profile information for each one of these enterprises, basically we were looking at their impact statement, so how many people have they reached, or if they don't have a specific metric for people, we sort of, you know, make an estimate for how many people we assumed they would be helping, that at the very most, these enterprises were only helping about 5% of the 1.4 billion people living without electricity in the world. In other words, they're barely scratching the surface. So here we have an interesting issue. Energy is obviously a very important and crucial aspect of development, recognized by the UN and other development agencies around the world. Yet, still today, we have 1.4 billion people living without electricity and 3 billion people living without clean cooking fuels. And even though there has been initiatives by social enterprises, creative, entrepreneurial people like those described by Phil, we still have a missing gap. So now I'm going to turn it over to Emily, and she's going to talk about the potential for social enterprises to meet this gap. I mean, what sort of, as now that I've described the problem statement, she'll talk a little bit more about the aspirational side of this.
Okay, yeah. So basically, why is energy such a big deal? You know, why does the UN, you know, scramble to kind of put all these initiatives together after the fact, after they had, well, what we had up on there before is the Millennium Development Goals. I mean, there has to be a really, really compelling reason in terms of development for everyone to be focusing on energy so much now. And the reason for that is it has a very, very strong tie to economic development. And that's something that Jack and I witnessed this summer in the field and that the UN has pieced together, you know, since 2000. So what we're going to show you now is kind of the formal basis for the rest of our presentation. This is kind of the way that we break down energy. So we talked before about how energy is sort of different things to different people, and what you see on this diagram is sort of a visual interpretation of that. So at the bottom, at the most basic level, you have what we're calling basic, which is a single light, maybe a phone charger, and maybe a cook stove. It's just a single item that doesn't transmit power to other things, basically. So it's kind of the end of the line. And then you go one step up the ladder and you have appliances. And this can be something like computers or maybe a solar home system, a small one, a set of couple lights, something like that, like a small microwave that can help do other things but is still fairly simple. And then if you go up another step, you have integrated systems, which we consider kind of to be community level. They can serve like maybe a family or a small or medium enterprise. We're targeting here larger businesses or schools maybe. So, and the grid level is at the top where you have total access. So you have access to everything on the grid. You have basically everything below it as well. To tie back in with what Jack was saying earlier, maybe the villager kind of level where you have the cook stove as the basic and then the appliances. What did you say for appliances?
A small or medium enterprise.
Yeah. Working,
you know, like the vendor.
Yeah, the refrigerator kind of thing, and then the hospital, and then the government, basically, that runs the grid. So we kind of think of these as tiers of energy access, and as different social enterprises and different partners, you know, kind of like the government, different stakeholders, address, when they think about energy, they address different tiers of this. And social entrepreneurs especially have, you know, specific targets. So what's so great about energy access? How does it unlock economic potential? There's kind of this term thrown around in the development world called productive use of energy, and it's this theory that some types of energy are basically more useful than others and can be used to basically like affect more change than maybe the more basic levels. And so let me read you a definition of productive use of energy. It's defined as activities that involve the application of energy to create goods and or services which either directly or indirectly generate income or value. So essentially, productive use of energy is how you use energy to create small and medium-sized enterprises to economic development. And Jack actually studied this for a while at the center last year. He wrote a paper about it. So you should look at it. So basically, I observed kind of the productive use of energy through Solar Sister this summer when I was talking to women on the field. And I definitely thought of it as a direct and an indirect approach. So there's sort of the indirect approach, which is the indirect benefit, I should say, when you talk to a woman who sells solar lights and she tells you that she can now send her children to school because of the money she's making selling energy products, basically. And so that is obviously an economic development, but it's not an energy directly related one. So the direct impact is when you talk to customers, and customers tell you, now I have light to see at night, and I can, you know, do whatever with it that maybe relates to economic development, maybe it's just a quality of life improvement. But so that's the social impact of a light or of energy access in a developing country can be kind of twofold. You have economic stimulus of basically the business coming in and doing work, and then you have the actual impact of whatever product is now in the market. So this is kind of the most visual example of talking to a customer. So this is Kevin and Katrina are smiling because they remember going to interview Hilda. This is a woman named, she's not in the picture actually, but the mother of the girl you see, her name is Hilda, and she's a Solar Sister customer. And by day, Hilda is a teacher at a school in Gulu, which is in northern Uganda. So far north, you're almost in Sudan. And but basically, when she's not at school, she's a Solar Sister, and she sells Solar Sister's products to her network of people that she knows through the school and then she knows in her community. And not only does she do these two things, she doesn't sell them, but she buys them. And she works with Jane, one of our favorite Solar Sister regional coordinators that we met. And what was so impressive about Hilda was the way that she was using the solar lights that she was buying. So she wasn't just, enjoying the light that she could now use at home. She was running a catering business, and she takes care of 10 children, which is a little bit absurd by our standards, but pretty standard, you know, in places like Uganda. And of course, not all of them are her children. Maybe half, maybe seven. I can't exactly remember, but it's not all of them. She takes in. For example, she told us that her maid had passed away, and so her daughter became Hilda's daughter. You know, that's kind of how it works. So Hilda has to support people, and the way she does it is through her catering business, which requires her to go away on the weekends and spend some time with, at parties or at weddings or at introductions, which is kind of like a debutante ball in rural Uganda. So basically, they make these cakes, which you can see mimic the huts that are found in rural Africa. And the lights allow her to stay at the site of the party and clean up after, you know, the sun's gone down. So without solar, without the portable qualities of solar and the renewable, the free aspect of it, you know, it doesn't cost any money to get energy from the sun, her business would not be able to function the way that it is. So that was a really interesting example for us to see of sort of the direct and indirect aspect of solar and the economic potential that can be unlocked by increase energy access. Phil.
Thank you so much, Emily. So what she talked about with Hilda is direct impact. She has light, she can work when it's dark. I worked with Anandeep and iMerit, and their impact is because of energy, not specifically because of light, because they have access to these forms of energy, so it's indirect impact. Now, Anandeep and iMerit are not energy enterprises, they are not providing energy, but they still provide a huge social impact because they use energy in a productive way, as Emily described earlier. So Anandeep was started in 2005 after ActionAid in Stanford did a study in the Ganges region south of Kolkata, which showed that economies of desperately poor and marginalized people can be dramatically impacted by increasing local employment. So there was already energy access there, And what they did is they set up these centers teaching IT, English, and workplace readiness in order to get these villagers able to be placed in career-building jobs. iMerit was then spun out of that to facilitate the amount of graduates and tap the growth of the BPO sector. So again, because of this energy, to date, HonorDeep and iMerit have 16,000 graduates, 112 centers, and 80% job placement upon graduation from the program. But what do these numbers mean? So this next slide, this is Musarrala Jahan, and she was my favorite interview in India by a long shot. She's 21, she's been working at iMerit for 3 months, and she is a student at Harinam Ghosh College nearby in Metia Bruz. Now, the center she works at is Metia Bruz, which is a Muslim suburb of Kolkata, about an hour outside. And she, a lot of the women in Metia Bruz are expected to grow up, marry, and be housewives. When we interviewed her, she talked about being teased because she worked there. She was told that she would not be able to do it, that she did not have the authority to be working outside the house, and that she had no respect from her male peers. And her father did not support her working there for the first 2 months. But what changed? Musarrala brings home triple the average family income in Metia Bruz, which she uses to pay for her college tuition, as well as both of her brother's college tuition. So she is not only enabling herself, but also both of her brothers. When we change the financial valuation of women, it creates a different perspective on the gender roles. But all of this is enabled because of energy access. Again, none of this indirect impact can happen unless social enterprises innovate in these areas and provide basic energy access to allow energy to be used in a productive way, as Emily said. The importance of energy as a resource cannot be understated.
Okay, so here we are, sort of at the end of our presentation of the current state of affairs for energy and development. And up here we basically have sort of a thesis that clean energy is a way to unlock economic potential. And we've seen this on two different levels. First, Emily's example of the people working at Solar Sister have the ability to run their businesses a little bit later, or maybe have a little bit more security because they have light at night. And that's sort of the basic direct impact of the provision of something like energy. And again, if you think back to that chart with the four tiers, that is the basic level and the first tier impacts of energy. But then we move to Phil's example of HonorDeep and iMerit, which is essentially a business, a social enterprise that has created a tremendous amount of social good in India. And this is quite a remarkable enterprise in terms of what it does for its employees and what it does for the creation of social good. And their focus is not on energy whatsoever. I mean, they're not providing energy, they're not providing clean cook stoves or anything like that. But underlying the entire aspect of, you know, the entire HonorDeep and iMerit operations is the provision of energy. They wouldn't be able to run their computer banks, they wouldn't be able to use cell phones or telephones or anything, or, you know, I think it was transcribing documents or digitizing documents. None of that would be possible without energy in some form or another. So the focus here is on clean energy, and this is an interesting point that we'll sort of discuss when we get into more of our discussion phase of this. But we know that clean energy is hypothetically the goal because of the benefits that it brings to the environment and the health issues and sort of national security issues. And we can say from what we've discussed that social enterprises seem to be the logical answer. NGOs and companies like that that might be working with this and you know, toying around with these ideas, more or less we've sort of determined them to be more useful in terms of funding and research. Which is crucial nonetheless, but they're not actually really the boots on the ground people so much as these enterprises can be.
And on the other hand, you have governments, which in America we depend on the governments and other, you know, agencies like PG&E to provide us with energy and expand the grid. So government and grid is on the other side of that spectrum. And as I discussed, in the developing world, this is something that's not really happening. The expansion of the grid isn't happening at the correct rate for the amount of people that are being born and moving to cities and demand that's growing for energy in the developing world. It's woefully behind. And not to mention that most of this grid expansion projects are in the developing world are not focused on renewable energy sources. So we've landed on social enterprises as being a way to bring clean energy to people, to provide an opportunity to increase the economic well-being of people in the developing world. But as we mentioned before from our analysis of the energy map, they're barely scratching the surface of the amount of people that remain without electricity. So the question sort of becomes, what is the role of, or how can we help these social enterprises, which is we've identified as being the correct agents for bringing clean energy to underserved communities, how can we help them scale meaningfully? And this is a question that people working at the Center for Science, Technology, and Society tackle on a daily basis. This is the core. How do we help these entrepreneurs and these exciting and inspirational people get to a meaningful scale so that they could actually maybe take out a larger chunk of the 1.4 billion people living without electricity? So this sort of marks a transition in our talk where we'd really like to open this up to you guys. There's a lot of expertise in this room, a lot of people who have dealt with this before, people who have seen it in the developing world. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to pose some questions to one another, largely unanswered through our research, but what we consider to be the interesting concept. So if anybody has any comments or insights or questions for us or for each other, please feel free to jump in at any time. And Nikki can help with that. So, Em, do you want to do the first one? Yeah, talk about
Western. Oh, okay. So kind of what Jack had just talked about, how do we help social enterprises scale meaningfully? That's kind of our first topic of discussion. And how do we introduce the Western idea?
Well, one of the things we were discussing about, while we were conducting our research is sort of what is the focus on social enterprises as a concept? I mean, what does it mean to be a social enterprise? And Phil described these as being sort of the triple bottom line.
So to kind of give you an idea of why this was interesting to us, at the GSBI Accelerator this past summer, each of the fellows was paired with a specific social enterprise, and the one that I was paired with was Nishant Bioenergy. And the social entrepreneur, Ramesh, and I had a conversation one time where I was asking him about basically, how he had come to be here right now and how his company worked and anything like that. And he, what struck me after a conversation with him, which he confirmed actually right after I asked him, was he doesn't think of himself as a social entrepreneur. He's here, he's in California all the way from India to do a two-week accelerator or week, and a half accelerator on his social enterprise and getting that social enterprise to scale. And he's being bombarded with entrepreneurship jargon and terminology, and people are helping him develop his business model. And when you ask him, he says, no, he's just a businessman. And he's here to work on his business model. And it made me think, because to him, I mean, his business is just a business. And he doesn't, he's a smart businessman to know that he can tap into all these networks in the United States and other parts of the world that exist to help someone like him help people in India, which we consider to be a place of need. And so we kind of found this discrepancy between what makes it qualified to what qualifies him to be a recipient for all of this help and advice versus maybe the provider of energy to even though someone you want to talk about
IRA? I was going to talk about IRA, but I think this idea of would we classify a company such as PG&E as a social enterprise. They are providing energy to us, and but they also may be building networks to provide energy in places in the United States where they have not had energy before. So providing rural access to energy, but are they providing social good as Nishant is in India?
So what we kind of came to was, is social entrepreneurship just a Western concept?
Does it exist? I mean, can you be a social enterprise in the United States? If we've established that the provision of energy is a crucial part of development or maintaining development, I mean, if we lost our energy, our society would assume fall apart to an extent. So is a company like PG&E that's providing electricity, regardless of whether it's in the United States or in a developing country, is that a social enterprise? Or is it just dependent on the context that it is? And furthermore, do we define enterprises to be social enterprises out of some sort of Western guilt or some sort of bias that we have towards the developing world, where a person like Ramesh doesn't see himself as creating social good? I mean, he sees a business opportunity and has identified a way to, you know, leverage his supply chain and basically create a very robust business and successful business in India. And he just happens to fit with our concept of what it means to be a social enterprise. So having, you know, providing a social good, he creates cook stoves. I'm not sure if we talked. He creates cook stoves, a carbon neutral cook stove. So he uses agricultural waste, it turns them into fuel pellets, which can be used for this low emissions cook stove, which he then sells to restaurants and people like that. So that aligns with our triple bottom line. I mean, he's creating an economic good for the people who own the restaurants, and he's creating his own economic good by producing these stoves. He's hitting the environmental side by making them carbon neutral. But why is he a social enterprise?
Yeah, the question that we want to ask you, or if you guys have any input, is there a problem there? Is that all right? I mean, is it not? Lauren? These are all great comments.
What do we consider to be a social enterprise? Are you doing it for the money or are you doing it for the social good? And it's I would say that that's a very problematic view of what it means to be working for development. I don't necessarily see that that the two are mutually exclusive of one another. Making a profit and providing a social good shouldn't necessarily be separate. And this is a point that we'll touch on, and we can go there now if we want to. But.
Well, one of the other things about profit-generating models in favor of them being social enterprises is that they have a more promising sustainability selling point. You know, I mean, if you're making money on your own, you don't need to go out and search for money every year, which anyone can tell you takes a lot of your time. There's the counterpoint, I guess, to the idea that, you know, we want people to be doing these for the right reasons. But you know, if they are making money, then it's probably going to have a bigger impact.
But then how do you delineate what is the right reasons and who is the person to validate those reasons?
Right. Yeah.
Lizzie?
I don't know. So what I'm sort of getting here from like what we are defining people is like the people we're saying aren't. Social enterprises are well-established, really large companies, and the people we are saying are startups,
yeah.
Are like the new ones who are coming in to fill this gap. Mm-hmm. If like established companies do it, then they're not social enterprises. But why is that? If this guy is really just considers himself a businessman, is it really doing it about the social good? It's more just of a side benefit.
Just to progress this a little bit. The question of how do you help social enterprises scale is something that we are unable to answer, and how the center is still working on it. I mean, it's largely an unanswered question. It basically boils down to it depends on what kind of business you're working with, what sector, what the cultural context is. There's tons of different variables that go into answering that question. But the fact of the matter is that institutions like the center here at Santa Clara are focusing on social enterprises. And when you become classified as a social enterprise, you garner a certain amount of attention from the community that you would otherwise not get. So a company like Nishant doesn't consider himself to be a social enterprise. He doesn't consider himself to be a social entrepreneur. And yet, for some reason or another, he stumbled upon this idea that in the West, hey, people are going to give me money because look at all the great stuff I'm doing. When in reality, I mean, another good example is Cusp Power System. That's also in India. The CEO, Manoj, he started this company that makes biogas digesters. So he puts agricultural waste into these power plants that turn it into a gas and burn it. He provide electricity to like villages of 500 people. And the question is he really doing that to reduce the carbon footprint of the Indian population, or is he really doing that so that he can bring light to the underserved communities, or is he an entrepreneur thinking, look at this opportunity I have because there's no grid here and because there's this agricultural waste here, look at this opportunity I have to make some money. So to Alex's point, that is a monetary motivation for him to start that business. That is something that's purely business related. The social impact is something that we've sort of projected onto this business, and it's lucky that Manoj has, can align those things. But the question sort of becomes, what if a company in India started providing energy based on a coal-fired power plant or some other sort of dirty energy? I mean, what if there was a way to provide energy that wasn't renewable or that didn't align with the social goals that we've established in the West here? And if that's the case, are we missing out on an opportunity as an institution that looks to try and help these businesses grow? Are we missing an opportunity to increase that 5% impact to a larger, impact based on expanding our definition of who we help?
And one of the things we were talking about when we were kind of discussing all this is if you're a social entrepreneur and you're working in, whoever you are, you're working in India and you want to make energy access available to everyone, why are you not allowed to use, non-renewable energy sources? The whole, the rest of the world, basically, the 6.5 billion with electricity, we all have pretty much, mostly non-renewable energies powering our grid. So are we putting too much pressure on social entrepreneurs to provide both energy and be environmentally conscious? So it should have just be a double bottom line, instead of a triple bottom line. Is that too much to ask?
Well, I think that's like one of the big problems with developing countries. You look at the consent curve, whatever it's called, where developing countries are willing to risk all of their environment. But if you can leapfrog past that, you can leapfrog past the grid and only use solar, if you can leapfrog past all these old technologies with the same, without sacrificing economic goals, like, why wouldn't you do that, I guess? Like, that's not necessarily like social good, it's like an economic perspective as well. It's like, why would you bother going backwards?
So say that making a non-renewable energy grid is going to happen a lot faster. I mean, with that motivation, do you still have a problem?
I think that it'll go out, like it'll kind of be pointless 20 or 50 years down the line. Like, yeah, like there's a whole plant coming online every single day in China. How long are they going to be around? Like, it's not a sustainable business model. And no matter how not socially oriented you are, you want a company to last longer than 15 years.
And so, sorry.
I was just kind of commenting on that. I feel like America, the United States, and a lot of other countries have kind of played a guinea pig role, you know what I mean, in development, and we've done things right, we've done things wrong. And so, I mean, why not? I mean, why try to develop other nations, you know, in the same way that we have? I mean, why just not eradicate everything, kind of, you know, correct our mistakes kind of thing, and ensure that, you know, it doesn't proliferate?
To that, I would say that if, as a center, our goal is to benefit 1 billion people by the year 2020, are we inhibiting ourselves by putting that burden on the people we're trying to help? I mean, is it better in the case that, Lindsay, you're talking about those power plants are coming online every day, and they might only be around for 20 or 30 years, but the benefit that a power plant coming online in the developing world could have is... I mean, it's illustrated by Anubis and Imera.
The question of indirect, the indirect potential is one that really you have to set against the triple bottom line. Are we sacrificing some sort of indirect potential by withholding social entrepreneurs to the triple bottom line? Or should we release them and allow them more flexibility and thus create a much greater possibility for the sort of indirect potential that Anubis and Imera create? And by the way, as Jack researched last night,
just to make sure.
Yeah. Anudeep and Imera run off of coal fired. The centers in Kolkata run off of coal fired plants.
So,
and just to add to that, a lot of economists say that the challenges of the developing world are actually quite different from what the developed world has gone through in terms of their economic stages, and the developing world will not follow those exact same stages and gain the same growth. And I mean, just things like population makes the issues so much more complicated, because while we may be able to have non-renewable energy, if a country like India or parts of Africa with such high population tried to go through the same kind of growth that America has gone through, I think the consequences environmentally would be much more significant than what has happened with us. And so it might be wise for them to actually look ahead, because, I mean, like China right now is suffering with air pollution, and if they don't look at that and say, oh, what is it going to be 20 years from now, then that's going to be a problem for them.
I mean, going off of that, I was going to say, if we do switch to a non-renewable energy source and happen to reach the goal in 2020 will be sitting there with smiles on our faces, like, hey, look, we accomplished our goal. But if by 2025, we're looking for those sorts of enterprises that can help fight this non-renewable energy problem that we've just created by the rapid expansion in the 7 years we put in until 2020, like, we're just looking for another social enterprise to help alleviate the problems that we just had with not using non-renewable energy sources. So although we do put that burden on us, and it is a heavy burden, I mean, people try to come up with different revolutionary ideas every day, but I mean, the burden actually, if we do reach that success point and find a solution to that problem, will result in a far greater success than just switching the switch now and saying, go ahead, use non-renewable energy. Empower the grid and, do all this indirect things, but although that does produce a success right now, we're still looking at failures in the future, which is why I think we put the burden on ourselves, is because we do look ahead at the future and what that could mean for the future of,
Can I jump in here? I think, Miles, it's a good point. But I would say that you said multiple times that we're putting the burden on ourselves. We're putting on the burden on ourselves to do this. And I would say, in fact, that we're not. By focusing so heavily on making sure that the developing world is focusing on clean energy, we're shirking the burden off on them. We are the ones who have established this status quo, dirty energy type thing. And not only that, but we're the ones with the resources to rethink that in our own context. I would be hard-pressed to go to somebody in the developing world, who is facing the choice between having energy provided or not having energy provided based on the fact that one is clean and might impact the larger global environment and the other one is not. When having that energy to that person means so much more, it impacts their lives so much, like, thorough. I mean, you can't run a business like Andrew Dip and I Mayor. I mean, what if we shut off the power plant in Kolkata and Andrew Dip and I Mayor went out? There you'd lost 100 jobs that company has created. And I guess so, I mean, we're talking about this. We wanted to do this earlier, but this is sort of how we thought as we were going through this process and thinking about these questions. We wondered, are we limiting ourselves and are we limiting the social good that could be done by focusing so heavily on clean energy? And we just wanted to do that and switch clean energy undermining economic potential by focusing so heavily our attention and our resources, of which we have in abundance here in the developed world, to generate this sort of, to achieve this goal of providing energy and therefore unlocking economic potential. Is it a matter of protecting the larger environment in the long run, which I agree is a very important goal, or is it a matter of helping the people now that need it now?
Yeah, and we could debate these questions all night, but we only have a couple more minutes left, so should we open it up for
any burning questions or comments that anyone has?
Or rebuttals from the center staff?
Yeah, the center staff. You've been very quiet.
So I'm curious if you just take the social out of it, the cost of building centralized coal-powered plants, for example, how that compares to distribution of solar power lanterns and economic benefits to the local communities. How do those compare? If your thesis is maybe we should invest in these centralized plants, is it really more economically efficient?
Well, as we know from the World Bank statement that electrifying the world, in order to reach their goal of providing sustainable energy for all by 2030, it's going to be $485 billion
per year,
and that's focused on sustainable energy. I mean, it's an expensive undertaking, regardless of how you dice it up. So, I mean, I guess I don't know enough to be able to say, what is the cost and how much economic potential are we creating if we do a coal-fired power plant? And
well, I mean, the thing about distributed energy is that there's just more of it. So, I mean, on a really, really high level, I would guess maybe that would have more, impact on people, more high touch, of a implementation system than a centralized system, which would probably use the same people going in and doing the same things. But it's distributed, you have to work everywhere. Yeah. No, please.
Go ahead.
That's a small point, but I think that for some places in the world, like non-clean energy is actually the reason that for it's something that undermines economic potential. Like places like islands and other places that actually they don't have access to dirty fossil fuels, or like it's too expensive to import them. So like renewable energy is actually a better way to go economically.
But where do the majority of the people living in poverty exist? I mean, we're talking India and China and Africa, which, I mean, smaller island, I agree with the point, but smaller islands are also a smaller proportion of the global poor.
Point still valid.
Last comment?
A big thing with people like Piedmont Islands, I guess, they are more motivated because
right.
all the people who, like the majority of poor people in the world, live in areas that are going to be more affected by global warming, sea level rise, all these various things. So if they're not choosing not to adopt these technologies and they have all these global threats coming their way, they will be, I guess, taking on their equivalent of the burden instead of the U.S. They'll also be flooded and not have homes in the next 50 years.
Yeah, they have more motivation.
All right, well, thank you everyone for coming. I think we all learned a lot. I learned a lot.
The Center for Science, Technology, and Society, accelerating global innovation-based entrepreneurship in service to humanity.
For more information on the center, visit www.scu.edu/social benefit.